Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. I am pleased to welcome back Darren Moore Jr. He was with us last year in April. We talked about, do private cryptos have a future? The Trump pivot is upon us, and with that comes the crypto pivot, and private currencies clearly have a future. Darren, welcome back, and thank you for joining me on the Solari Report, and thank you for your recent coverage. I've been on your channel looking at some of the things you've done recently, and I just have to say you're very good at transcribing pretzel talk for your listeners and audience. So Darren just had posted the Danish central banker talking about sort of what's going on with cross-border payments, and you kept stopping it and then explaining what she said, and I thought it was really marvelous.
Sian Krogstrup is a governor at the Denmark Central Bank. She once worked for the IMF as well as the Swiss National Bank, which is their central bank. Now, she is going to reveal some very telling things that are happening in the world of cross-border payments as well as crypto assets at large.
We have a focus on this very much from a risk perspective at a bank. That means that whatever comes next could be, we could see more volatility, more risks, and that means that we need to have a financial system that is resilient. Cross-border payments is developing really fast. I come from a region, the Nordic region, where we have already very fast instant payments within our currency areas. And we are, in fact, in the Nordics already now transitioning to being able to do instant payments on retail level across currencies. Another thing that might not be as well understood is that all the Nordics are currently moving their real-time settlement infrastructures to the target services platform, to use the target services platform of the ECB. So we will, in different speeds now, all be on the same platform, which gives us new possibilities to improve further payments in the European Union. One of the parts of the target services, which is really interesting, is the TIPS platform. And all this has now been made multi-currency. That means that it was all developed for the euro, but it is now being developed also for the Danish krona, for the Swedish krona. The Swedes are already on. We will be joining the whole target services next year at Easter. And the exciting part is that we already have the project of going from multi-currency to cross-currency. That means that we will soon have the ability to do real-time gross settlement of retail payments on the TIPS platform across currencies cheaply and efficiently. And this is really around the corner, so it is coming.
This is also what they're trying to achieve with Project Icebreaker that the BIS is heading up. Central banks are loading up on dollars because their currencies are dropping. Correspondents are using dollars as a safe haven, making the dollar stronger. This causes havoc in America's markets. The dollar's strength is no good for exports or equities. America can no longer be the central bank of the world and take care of its own economy. Having the reserve currency certainly has helped America achieve greatness, but now it's more of a liability. Trump understands this problem, and the last time he was in office, he attached his name to the stock market and to bring manufacturing back home.
Because if we set up settlement structures that are based on crypto, we do need some settlement asset in those structures.
The world is becoming tokenized, and in order for value to move from one network to the next, there needs to be a liquid asset. If the asset is neutral, then America can compete with foreign trade. The Fed can focus on this economy in a vacuum versus juggling the global economy and the national economy.
Because if we set up settlement structures that are based on crypto, we do need some settlement asset in those structures. And one asset could be tokenized bank deposits. And then we're simply back to a bank-based model on a different platform.
Tokenized deposits recreates this system in the tokenized world. You see, Basel III requirements will no longer be a benefit because it's the same exact thing as the current system that we have. Treasuries are going to go berserk. The DXY is pumping. This is the perfect storm to destroy this system as the rails are being set for this new crypto world.
So where did you learn how to talk central banking pretzel talk?
Well, I would listen to just like a Ripple type of type of conferences, just listen to what they had to say. And then I would listen to the central bankers talking, and I'd hear them parallel each other. So then I would just keep listening to the central bankers speak, and I'd find clips. And then when I would post it, it seemed like it had the type of response you would think it would have from a lot of the crypto investors, because it almost echoes each other. It's pretty much the same thing coming out of somebody's mouth.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, okay. So let's dive in. I want to talk about three things today. I want to talk about the crypto pivot, because we're watching a dramatic pivot in Washington regarding approach to private cryptos, how private cryptos fit in with public policy, including the use of stable coins to really broaden the market for dollars and treasuries. So I want to talk about the crypto pivot. And then with that, a little bit more about Ripple and what Ripple is, how it works, and then asset tokenization as well. So, and you're a very good teacher. So remember, we have a wide audience from people who are exceptionally knowledgeable to people who are like me. It's like, what? What is that? So we're going to try and, you don't mind if I interrupt with stupid questions. Anyway, So tell us about what has happened in terms of what I call the Trump pivot. What is the pivot now? What is happening right now in crypto as a result of the new administration?
Well, Trump was never like super into crypto. It just, that's more of like a recent thing that's come up. So prior to this, he used to talk about gold wanting the dollar as like a reserve currency, having the dollar in the center of the whole financial infrastructure, and then he would be favorable towards gold, but not so much towards Bitcoin. As a matter of fact, if you go back to some of the earlier interviews, he's always kind of downplaying crypto or not taking it very seriously. And just this last, I don't know, couple months, then that he started to look more favorably towards it. I think a lot of the Bitcoin investors were able to lobby Trump before he ran for president. So he made good with a lot of his promises for a Bitcoin strategic reserve, which to me is pretty nuts to have, you know, to take money from people that are paying in taxes and bet it on Bitcoin. But that's one of the promises that he made. He promised to fire Gary Gensler. He promised to make sure that there's more favorable crypto regulations. And then recently, Garlinghouse from Ripple was able to have a dinner with Trump. Stu Alderotti and Brad Garlinghouse were able to have a dinner with Trump. And it sounded like they were able to try to sell him on the idea, instead of having a Bitcoin strategic reserve, they made it into a crypto strategic reserve, including all assets that have a lot of the US-based companies with their asset class too. So it's not just strictly Bitcoin, but XRP or Ondo or a lot of the US-based companies and tokens associated with. I don't know how they would even do that though, because the whole point is that it's decentralized, right? So if you have a US-based company that owns a stockpile of a digital asset, the whole point of the digital asset is it's decentralized. So why are we trying to cut hairs and say that, you know, this is US-based digital asset, this is not US-based digital assets? To me, that does not make a lot of sense.
So we just published a paper called Bitcoin Bailout, because I see the... What Trump promised during the campaign was that he would take the Bitcoin that had been seized, that is now controlled, owned by the Asset Forfeiture Fund, controlled by the U.S. Marshals, and not sell that. And so he wasn't going out in the market and proposing Treasury buy. He was proposing, okay, we won't sell off the assets. Normally, when you take an asset into the Asset Forfeiture Fund, you immediately, you know, on a timely basis, you sell it and get the proceeds. Anyway, but now, you know, now he's talking, as you said, about the possibility of buying more. But I see, you know, to me, buying a stable coin is a very different kettle of fish than buying Bitcoin. And to me, I can't. And unfortunately, they're not going to use tax money. You're running such big deficits. You've got to go sell treasuries and get the proceeds to buy Bitcoin, which to me is certifiably, you know, well, we everything we have to say is in Bitcoin bailout, but it's so negative. I can't, you know, we don't want to go down that rabbit hole because I'll spend all day trying to tear it apart anyway. But so that is one thing we need to think about. So let's talk about we've got a lot of people coming into the administration who have a background in crypto. So the new SEC head is has been basically a crypto lobbyist. And David Sacks is coming in on sort of a crypto czar, but I don't understand exactly what that is or what that means. Do you have any idea?
David Sacks, the PayPal guy, the all-in guy, is it's supposed to be like, I guess, somebody that gives guidance about like the policy that we should have. So he's trying, it's supposed to be the crypto NAR, AI czar. So he's, I guess that he would try to like, give the White House a type of advice on how to move forward with a lot of the regulations. I mean, they have one for like a border. So they have a border czar, they have the crypto czar. I think they have different categories, but in short, I don't know exactly what his day-to-day operation would look like other than just kind of tell the White House what would be expected of them.
And do you know anything about Sachs's position on regulations or anything that would tell us what he would do in terms of crypto or AI?
He's more of a laissez-faire type of attitude. He wants the free markets to kind of govern and push the free markets rather than having the U.S. government dictate policies and have the U.S. try to excel in order to take over an industry. I mean, a lot of this is a result of the previous administration pushing too far, right? Like they wanted things that were pretty much unfair for crypto. And now you're shooting in the other direction where it's almost like, you know, they're handicapping it in favor of. So that's what David Sacks is. When you listen to the All In podcast, that's what it seems that he's more interested in and trying to achieve, is trying to have, you know, more favorable things for U.S. industry and more laissez-faire type of attitude.
So one of the things that's happening is we're seeing an explosion of stable coins. So I want to turn to the most recent video you made. We're seeing an explosion of stable coins. It's basically selling stable coins and you take the money and you invest it in treasuries. And it's a way of expanding the dollar globally. And in fact, pushing dollars into all sorts of economies around the world. And if anything, it's very dollar aggressive, very dollar favorable. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the main benefits that they see is having some type of stable coin regulations, which should be the next iteration of regulations to come out. It's the most in line with what we currently have. It's not something that's like going to change everything, but it's pretty much in line with what we already have. And basically what happens is you bypass the banking system, just having banks issue stable coins. So they're able to set up a digital wallet and the banking rails don't need to be there. Just somebody that owns another wallet needs to be there. So the consumer to consumer type of payments happen directly. And this is a way to take a lot of the treasuries that are printed and find a use case for them, find a home for them, instead of having the banks load up on accounts that are backing deposits that they're issuing. It's you just directly back a token with treasuries, and it's a way to bypass the entire banking system and just have a way to get money directly to people.
First off, what is a stablecoin? A stablecoin is technically a utility token built upon another coin's blockchain. If you don't know the differences between what a coin and a token is, you should definitely check out our video on that topic. But the entire goal of a stablecoin is to create a cryptocurrency that isn't volatile and doesn't change price. A stablecoin is pegged to the US dollar and should always equal $1, theoretically. Bitcoin, the first cryptocurrency, was actually created to be used as a store of value. However, since it's not widely adopted and there aren't very many regulations on it yet, the price fluctuates a lot. So much so that it is classified as a speculative investment. So what if you want to store money using crypto technology, but you don't want to risk your investment with the price fluctuations of crypto in today's world? Well, you can use a trusted stablecoin. How do stablecoins work? Well, mainly, they work in two different ways. Collateralization, or through algorithmic mechanisms, also known as smart contract manipulation. Those are a lot of big words, but we're going to break it down for you. First off, fiat collateralization means that each coin is backed by something. In most cases, that is one US dollar. In some, though, it's other countries' currencies, like the euro, or even gold. Tether is, in fact, one of the most major companies that released their USDT stablecoin using fiat collateralization. Now, there are some rumors that they do not have a dollar for every USDT that they have minted. The pros of a fiat collateralized stablecoin is that they are quite stable, much more than the alternative. However, they do have problems. The first is that the money required to put up for each USDT cannot be invested. This could mean millions of dollars for that company that are not earning interest. Another problem is someone at the company could embezzle or steal a bunch of that collateral. And one last problem, specifically that Tether faces, is that it's very difficult to prove that you own the total amount of collateral. Let's move on to the second method, because as an alternative to the fiat collateralization method, some stablecoins are controlled by smart contracts. Some people call this algorithmically pegged stablecoins. Now, the benefit of this method is that it is very easy to audit. You just take a look at the smart contract code. Another benefit is that there's no physical assets to steal. However, some of the problems can seem much worse. Smart contract controlled stablecoins are usually much more volatile, simply due to how they work. What they do is they must manipulate the supply of their coins to adjust the price. Now, the algorithm differs among each stablecoin, but there are three main algorithms. We may actually make an entire video about these three specific algorithms. One changes the amount of coin in your wallet each time that you check it, so that the value stays roughly the same, $1. The second system uses a money printer and a bond reward system to adjust the price to $1. A third is very similar to the second, however, it uses something called coupons. Now it's time to be a little more pessimistic around the topic of stablecoins. While stablecoins do have good traits around them, there are a few things that you should think about before fully ditching your savings account and tossing all your savings into a stablecoin. First is the lack of insurance. When you put your money into a bank, savings, or checking account, it is actually insured by the government, at least if you're in the USA. Some banks are FDIC insured, meaning they'll repay up to $250,000 worth of money that is stolen or lost from the bank to you. Stablecoins do not have this advantage yet. If a company that started and is operating that stablecoin goes bankrupt, then you'll most likely lose all of your investment and be left empty-handed. Secondly, we have to bring back up the collateralization issue. Remember how we said that there were rumors that Tether may actually not be backed by true cash? If they aren't, and that scares people, the price could fluctuate a lot. It could even cause it to be unpegged to a dollar, because Tether is only worth what people think it is worth. And right now, that is $1. If the belief changes, then the value changes.
So if, let's say you have a country that has a currency that's falling in value against the dollar, isn't this a way that I can literally get all the citizens in that country who are transacting cross-border off of their currency and onto the dollar?
Yeah, it would be directly to those individuals. There wouldn't need to be a bank account process for it.
Right.
So you'd be able to just bypass that whole type of process. So instead of the US government just printing, this would be like what they were doing with a stable coin with CBDCs, but instead of having some type of mass centralized one entity creating the CBDC, you just have a bunch of the private sector create the stable coin. So you just have smaller businesses do it instead of a national champion do it. So it's really ingenious. They change it a little bit, and it's still much different, but at the same time, it's not much different. It's pretty much what they were trying to do with CBDC.
So it reminds me a little bit of during the Iraq War, they would print pallets of dollars and send them over and flood the economy with dollars. And that was a way of dollarizing the economy. And this is sort of a digital version So you just flood a country with dollars through the mobile payment system, avoiding the banks, avoiding the central bank, and you dollarize the economy.
Right. And I mean, that's the biggest trouble that we have with macroeconomic policy right now, is that the dollars aren't getting out into the world as easy. So it's like that's the main hindrance is just getting the dollar into different countries to use as a payments vehicle. Right now, the dollar is Triffin's dilemma. So you have the more currency that you print at home, the more that you need to print, and it causes a problem with the deficit in order to get it to be used as a settlement asset between different nations. So having the stable coin kind of hacks that entire path and allows the dollar as a settlement vehicle quicker and easier for nations to use. So I think that's kind of like the number one game plan is really Triffin's dilemma.
So here's the interesting thing. I had a big debate for many years with a wonderful ally in Sweden, and he always said the euro dollar market is outside of the control of the feds, because the euro dollars are, you know, is a huge dollar market, but it's all created outside of the US, and the Fed literally doesn't control the creation of those dollars. So I said, I was with somebody who's very high up in the custodian and system, in the settlement system. And I said to them, you know, you can settle this argument. Does the Fed have control of the Eurodollar market? And he said, technically, no. But if any bank ever does anything they don't like in the Eurodollar market, they just hiccup and freeze and mess with their dollar settlements. And they go back to doing what they're told. So here's the question. How... you know, if you're running a stablecoin operation, reaching into citizens around their sort of national infrastructure all around the world, but you're using treasury bills, to me, the New York Fed and the Fed can still end up controlling.
Yeah, well, I mean, the euro dollar market's kind of opaque, right? Because you have bank account upon bank account, and it's multi-layered, so you can't really get down to the heart. The heart of it is treasuries, right? So with stable coins, you'd be able to see directly into who owns the stable coin, what collateral is back to what stable coin. So you'd be able to make it more transparent. Right now, it's really opaque, because it's bank account upon bank account, and you don't know exactly who is the owner of all the bank accounts. You don't even know if the collateral really even exists. So, with a stable coin, it's just going directly to the asset, to the liability and the assets directly on one ledger. You're able to see everything. And then you would be able to see, like if you look at Etherscan, you could type in someone's Ethereum wallet address, and you could see exactly what's in each wallet. So that would be a way to make it much more transparent than the way it is now.
Tether, to me, doesn't look like a stablecoin. It looks like a mystery coin. So there's no way to prove it's collateralized.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they used to have... when it was Brock, like the actor, he was in charge of Tether for a while. The site used to have the collateral that was backing each asset, and then they moved away from that. Now, since Pablo is now the stablecoin guy, it seems like it's more opaque than ever, but. I don't know. I found footage of Howard Lutnick talking about how they have like a Treasury Direct type of account with Tether. So I don't think that you would catch somebody like that lying about Cantor Fitzgerald backing Tether if it wasn't true. So I think a lot of people are like eager to see Tether collapse, but think about the blowback that like Trump would get over that. Think about like all the people that became favorable towards crypto in like the last, you know, couple 6 months if this dispute's imploded on them.
I just have to stop you for a second, because in the securities market, there is very strict securities law related to full and fair disclosure to investors and the obligation of any dealer, whether in the primary or secondary markets, to provide full and fair disclosure. At the same time, the primary dealers, of which Cantor Fitzgerald is one, has led a process of basically sucking trillions of dollars out of U.S. retirement savings accounts and all over the world for an operation that is massively in violation of the financial management laws, and they're $21 trillion missing. So I don't trust a primary dealer to tell the truth. There's nothing you can do to get me to trust a primary dealer. So if you look at the, I have a lot of documentation on this, and trust me, you want to be very careful about what a primary dealer says. So I think Howard Lutnick has tremendous confidence that Tether can keep going no matter what. So,
well, I mean, like, not trusting them is probably the wrong word, but having them print money on a moment's whim just to make good on something is different than trust, right? Like, to assume that that wouldn't print money for Tether's backing to me seems very plausible that since he was saying those things, that it's plausible. Right. They do have the backing of one of the Wall Street entities and have some type of.
It could be the Exchange Stabilization Fund. They may have backing from the Exchange Stabilization Fund that the New York Fed runs to make sure there's no liquidity problems on Tether. So,
right. And think about the bigger scam at play, right? Like what we're talking about with the Triffid's dilemma is like there's so much money that's spread across the world.
Right.
If something bad were to happen with the stable coin right before they tried to initiate one of these plans to try to use stable coins for Triffid's dilemma, like we're talking about like a drop in the bucket compared to what they want to do. So I just think that the bigger scam is to try to usher everybody into a stable coin,
right,
and use that as a de facto CBDC versus, you know.
Well, I think first and foremost, what they want to do is dollarize as many people and places as they possibly can.
Yeah.
And it's really a way for the dollar syndicate to stay primary. And they don't care, you know, they don't care if it's the official dollar or the euro dollar or the stablecoin dollar. They just want the syndicate to remain primary. And what they can do is they can use this to basically drain sovereignty around the world. So it's, you know, it's not necessarily a pretty picture. Okay. So so let's talk a little bit about Ripple, because I think one of the most important issues here is what is the what are the possibilities in terms of significantly improving efficiency in cross-border payments, and what are the dangers of doing that? And to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, the one payment system that looks like it's been developed to really be an alternative to the banking system as a cross-border payment system is Ripple. And a lot of money and time and infrastructure and a lot of venture capital has gone into building out a global infrastructure to do that. So tell us a little bit about Ripple. What is it and what is it up to right now?
In 2013, the Federal Reserve began looking for faster payments options. 2 years later, an action plan was born and a federal payments task force was created. It included one company focused on crypto, Ripple. In 2014, the World Bank and Better Than Cash Alliance, which includes the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Clinton Global Initiative, and the governments of 32 countries, put out a report called The Opportunities of Digitizing Payments. 1 year later, the Better Than Cash Alliance featured one crypto company on their website, Ripple. Today, Better Than Cash Alliance and all other UN initiatives are focused on a single agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals for 2030. You can see the SDGs logo on Bill Gates' lapel, world-leading companies, the Better Than Cash Alliance website, and on the UN's official exchange, Xchange. What crypto is Xchange officially utilizing for their carbon credit solution? XRP. The world will move to a new international standard for exchanging electronic messages between financial institutions by 2025 called ISO 20022. who was the first ISO 20022 member focused on distributed ledger technology, Ripple, who's partnered with over 300 financial institutions, including Bank of America, American Express, PNC, Santander, SBI, HSBC, Standard Chartered Bank, Bank of England, India, Singapore, Scotland, Australia, and Indonesia, the largest banks in Japan, Canada, Egypt, the Middle East, United Arab Emirates, Thailand, Morocco, Bhutan, South Korea, Brazil, and Latin America, Ripple, who is a former employee overseeing the Federal Reserve, Ripple, a former employee overseeing the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock's Digital Asset Division, Ripple, leading Australia's CBDC effort, Ripple, who hired a former Treasury of the United States, Ripple, two former Federal Reserve attorneys to their board, Ripple, two former Clinton and Obama advisors, former Minister of Defense and Economics of Germany, former Business Director at Swift, former Swift board member, former CFO of PayPal, former head of the DTCC, former Chief Business Officer at Uber, former VP of Amazon, and former SEC chair on their legal team, Ripple, who's a member of the Digital Pound Foundation, Digital Dollar Project, Digital Euro Association, Mojaloop, IMF's High-Level Advisory Board on FinTech, Hyperledger Blockchain Consortium, Open Payments Coalition, Faster Payments Council, Global Payment Steering Group, Cross-Border Working Group, International Association for Trusted Blockchain Applications, Crypto Climate Accord, University Blockchain Initiative, World Wide Web Consortium, and a featured partner of the World Economic Forum with three members of their team directly listed on the WF website, Ripple.
Now, does Ripple and XRP sound like they're going to disappear, or do they sound like they're part of a much bigger plan? You decide.
So Ripple is a private company. They created something called OpenCoin like really early on. I think it was 2012 that OpenCoin was created. It was later rebranded as XRP, but it was gifted to Ripple, and they had half of the supply of XRP. More than half was given to some of the founders to Ripple, and it was locked up into an escrow. So Ripple started creating something called XCurrent, and it was a product to try to make settlement time quicker. So payment time, settlement time. The payment time was XCurrent, where they'd send instructions, payment instructions between two different banks. Prior to this, it was a very long process just to have the payment instructions being sent. So that's where you'd see Swift take messages from one bank and send it to another bank. They updated that. I created something that was a little bit more up to date and pretty much sent it over encrypted messages through email instead of sending it through like old fashioned wires. So that was one element of it was the messaging system. And then the next element was using XRP as a settlement asset. So instead of sending fiat through these rails, they would send XRP through the rails in real time. But they needed to create marketplaces that were able to liquidate other currencies in real time in order to get the benefits of moving XRP where it was liquid, right? So the pairs of dollar to XRP or Bitcoin to XRP, all these different rails needed to be plugged directly into the banking infrastructure. So they started doing that, and then they started working on a bunch of other different products. They created their own CBDC line. They're creating a stable coin. They're creating like equities with different partnerships. So like there's a company called Archax is trying to make different equities being issued directly on the XRP ledger. And they sell that infrastructure to banking institutions and clients to try to get them more on board with the digital asset type of movement and to get them updated quicker. So if you're
a big bank, so let's say you're a bank in Spain and a bank in Tokyo, and why would you use Ripple instead of using the traditional wires?
It's quicker, cheaper, faster, more transparent. So like what we're talking about with Triffin's Dilemma, like a lot of the banking products are opaque. You don't know when they actually settle, so you have to kind of wait until the other bank messages you to tell you that they got the money before anyone knows. So it's more transparent. There is an argument for why would those banks hire Ripple when they can just create their own in-house type of solution using different technology. So that's an argument. So you usually see a lot of the mid-level banks gravitate towards Ripple, not so much like the huge banking partners. The huge banking partners usually create their own rails, while the mid-level ones usually partner with Ripple, so they don't have to bear on all the costs of it.
Mm-hmm. So I intermittently I will go see, just bump into a conference where you see Lagarde or somebody fairly official in the central banking system promoting Ripple. It seems to have early on become fashionable within the central banking community. So it has some kind of establishment support, and I've never quite known where that comes from.
Well, I think it's because of like the transparency part of this. They're able to have the banks follow regulations, and it's a quicker, more transparent way of doing so. So they're actually following the laws that those central bankers are putting forth for the banks in a fast, efficient manner without having to bypass anything. So it's still doing everything that they're supposed to be doing, but it's happening quicker and faster. So I think you're seeing a lot of the central bankers gear towards a Ripple net because it makes their life easier. I think it's, falling in line with what they are set out to trying to do, which is getting all the banks following the regulations, and they're just following them based on.
So the other thing I see is they're building out offices all around the world.
Yeah.
So they're building an organizational infrastructure to support a digital infrastructure. There's real human beings there to talk to you.
They're all across the world. And for a long time, the U.S. was not, there wasn't as many U.S. employees, and they were a U.S.-based company. So that's something they were really trying to push for. Ironically, though, Chris Larson, which was one of the early founders, gave $12 million to the Harris campaign, while Ripple gave it to both sides. And then once Trump looked like he was going to win, they gave more money to Trump. For a while they weren't involved with a lot of the U.S. based employees weren't there, so they had President Trump, they gave money to Trump to have him, try to squeak the wheel, so to speak, and try to get more.
If you look how strongly, because Larson's still listed as executive chairman.
Yeah.
So if you look at how strongly Larson was for the Democratic side, I'm wondering how that makes Ripple's navigating this environment, because this is clearly a very pay-to-play oriented administration.
Yeah, I would imagine there'd be some type of blowback, but it doesn't look like there has been. I thought for sure there'd be some type of retaliation that would happen. It seems like he's a bit egocentric, right?
Well, but here's the question. If you've got Atkins at SEC and you've got Sachs in the White House, what is their attitude? It's going to come down to what are they trying to get done and what's their attitude is going to be part of it, but it seems to me you've got a couple of companies that are, if you're going to focus on private crypto and you're going to use private crypto to help you, manage, you got all sorts of issues managing the dollar syndicate globally. And if they're going to help, then you can't afford to, not get everybody. It's like 20 mule teams. You need them all pulling in the same direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, okay, so let's just, I want to come back to Ripple and crypto, but I want to jump a little bit to asset tokenization, and we'll pull that back in. Explain as simply as you can, what is asset tokenization, and why is the BIS and a variety of people in this area, in the area of digital assets, interested in asset tokenization?
To put it simple, it's like what we're saying with stable coins. So you create a token and back it with an asset. So like one example would be just equities being tokenized. So all these ledgers, you're able to create tokens. So you can create as many tokens as you want. You can create many different types of tokens. So one of its functionalities is all these ledgers, you could make as many tokens as you want. So let's say that there's, I don't know, a million Tesla stocks. So each ledger is able to create a million tokens, and then that, each one of those tokens represents one Tesla stock. So I think what the big plan is trying to get away from archaic infrastructure that's extremely opaque, that's really, you know, walled gardens of banking institutions that the banks only have access to. It's very, very opaque markets into these ledgers that everyone can interact with. Everybody can look on, see what's on each ledger, and then have global marketplaces that are much more efficient and without having to trust intermediary. So a lot of what you see with the stock market, it's just layer upon layer of intermediaries that you have to put some type of trust in, thinking that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing right. So with these ledgers, like with any type of crypto asset ledger, you don't need to trust anyone. Everybody has the same exact ledger in front of them. It's not like, you know, my ledger is different than your ledger. Everybody sees the same thing at the same time, and you're able to see what kind of how many Tesla stocks or right. GE stocks, whatever stock, and it could be anything. It doesn't have to just be stock equities. It could be title insurance for cars or titles for homes, home equity. Matter of fact, Ripple is working with the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, which is like the Fed of Hong Kong. They're working on a home line equity credit. So to borrow against your home to get instant loans, and then you could use the instant type of loans to pay for anything. So I think a lot of what we're witnessing is those types of newer emerging markets to come forth, and not so much, you know, recreating like the stock market, but creating private equity or creating equity that's newer and has more use cases.
So you have more confidence in the technology than I do, but sure. But where it works properly, you're just, you know, if and when it works properly, you're describing it well. So I just spent some time at the BIS website earlier or late last week looking at their vision of literally creating a token on every asset on the planet and integrating it with the digital monetary system, which of course I know could be integrated with a social credit system. So it's sort of CBDC, but much worse, because all your assets are integrated in, and that makes it easier to liquefy your assets, which could be good or bad. But it also means it subjects your assets to a social credit system.
Right.
So it's basically a complete control grid in a manner I can see all sorts of very positive use for asset tokenization, but if you look at asset tokenization in the hands of people who want central control, it's absolutely frightening to me.
What is tokenization of real-world assets? Let's break it down for you. Tokenization is when physical assets like land, property, or art are turned into digital versions. These assets are broken into smaller parts called tokens, making them accessible to more investors. For example, imagine a beachfront hotel just built. The owner tokenizes it for 1 million, creating 1 million tokens at $1 each. Investors can buy as many tokens as they can afford, and as a token holder, you share in the hotel's income without all the paperwork or middlemen.
And also, like a private company, I think their bar is set a lot lower on like what they have to prove and not prove. Like a private company just doesn't have to do business with you, right? Like McDonald's doesn't want you to buy a hamburger from them and kick you out. But like a government entity, on the other hand, you try to say the DMV is not letting you get a license, well, then usually it's under a finer tooth comb, any type of government agencies. So I think the bar is a lot lower with having private companies try to create a de facto CBDC and just have the social credit part of this. Matter of fact, MasterCard was creating like green energy, like they're doing like a social credit score for like what you buy, and they give you a little rating, and it's all based on this type of technology. So you know, it's only a matter of time before that sinister plot that we saw with CBDCs just happened with stable coins.
Well, there are software companies that are going into the banks that are doing the same thing. They're setting up the data infrastructure to give you what you need to do a data, you know, to do a social credit system. So to me, it's if it's digital, it's there, whether it's, you know, whether it's public, whether it's private, whether it's the banks, whether it's crypto. You know, to me, the danger is an all digital system with a high quality digital ID, and then you're in another, you're on another planet in terms of control.
Yeah, right. It's scary, especially considering like everything is becoming unaffordable, right? Like Lyft, like Uber, those are like the new ways for transportation, because they're making cars so much money, right? Like they're just making it so much harder for like the little guy to even have something like car ownership, right? So it's like the more that they can control some type of system, like the more control that they will have, because there's just not that many options that are going to be there for everyone moving forward, you know?
Right. So let's say you were going into the White House instead of David Sacks as the White House crypto czar. What would your priorities be for the next year?
I mean, basically, like I think his priorities make sense to have some type of laissez-faire approach, because it was a lot of work not knowing like how they're going to roll it out, whether it be just from the larger technology companies being the ones that provide it. But I would try to ensure some type of safeguards for privacy. So a lot of this is all transparent, right? So I think having safeguards for privacy, being able to actually conceal transactions below a certain threshold, I think would be the right choice, because a lot of people are just going to have to just give up their privacy, and it'll be almost normalized that people won't have privacy. So that would be one thing that would be focused on, having some type of I don't know, access to capital too, right? Like there has to be rules set in forth like on what qualifies people to get some type of access to loans, what they need to do, and try to unwind some of the stuff that they already have, I pretty much see this as like almost like a hopeless situation. It just is like grinding the same type of axe until it's eventually getting to what they see fit, which involves a lot of just surveillance, honestly. So something to protect us from surveillance would be my number one thing.
Have you ever looked at what the states can do? Because the states have a lot of power under the Constitution to do things.
No, I haven't.
No. Okay. So we just published a big study called What the States Can Do. And it's about what the states can do to protect financial freedom. And I haven't focused as much on the actions they can do to protect privacy. But if you look at what they've done in the last year to stop, for example, people from being debanked or credit cards using merchant codes to stop them from buying what they want, you know, the states have done a lot and they can do a lot. So it's going to be fun to watch. It's also going to be fun to watch because right now the Fed, we're about to publish Sean Titus's War on Bankocracy series, which I'm very much looking forward to. And essentially the Fed is not out from under the Constitution yet, but if they find a way to wiggle the way out, you know, then they have a reason to suddenly get back in the game in a whole new way that they aren't doing now. You know, if anything, they're slow walking CBDCs.
Huh.
So, and I, if I were the Fed, you know, using stablecoin to help support the dollar, to me, is a very attractive approach, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it fits on so many different levels, you know, and like, I don't know, when I first started talking about CBDC, it's like there is almost like a visceral response from the public, and you don't see the same response from the public to the whole stablecoin thing, even though like you're pretty much having the same type of outcome. You're not seeing the blowback that people once had. I think because a lot of people are invested in crypto, so it's kind of like, oh well, it's going to help me out, so they're not fighting it.
I don't think it's that they're invested, although some are. I think it's that they don't understand how digital control could work on the private side. They understand the public. They don't understand the private. And, you know, there's been enough sort of explanation of the dangers of CBDCs. What they don't understand is CBDC is a potential digital control system that technically now legally is still under the Constitution, and the people who do it have legal obligations to the citizens. What they don't understand is there are ways of doing it privately where the people doing it have no obligations to the citizens, and it could be even darker than what we have now.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, it's going to be the Wild West. And part of this, of course, as we know, is how AI is going to get integrated into society. So because if you look at the data center infrastructure to do the AI, it's the same data, you know, cloud infrastructure to do whatever you do with currency or, you know, with the financial transactions.
Well, those transactions right now are behind opaque walls, right? So with AI having them in a transparent ledger, I mean, like the AI is going to be able to predict things that, you know, most people aren't going to know about themselves. They're going to be able to pick up on stuff before other people, right?
But here's the thing. If you look at me doing a banking transaction, it's all behind these OPEC layers. But if you look at the person I'm onboarding and offboarding with, they have all sorts of legal obligations to me, and I can have a conversation with them. So I just had an interview with Steve Kirsch, who has essentially been shut out of his Coinbase account. And so we're talking about this during the interview. We'll publish it tomorrow. And they won't let him wire money to his bank. He now is being told he can't onboard and offboard with his bank from his Coinbase account. And they've told him it's that the reason why is confidential to protect him. So he can't know why. And he's trying to figure out, well, how do I get money in and out? It's what I call the Roach Motel problem. You know, there's one way in and no way out. And he's trying to figure out what's going on. So in the interview, I was walking through the different ways he might be able to figure out what's going on, what the problem is, and what to do about it. And, you know, but if you look at the frustration he's going through, I can't tell you how many reports I have of people doing that, you know, with a crypto system, because they, you know, there's basically nobody, there's no relationship banking there. And there's nobody there who really has the kind of legal obligations to me that my bank does. So, you know, that both systems have a darkness problem and a secrecy problem and a failure to perform problem. You know, and I find people all over the world just wildly frustrated with both systems.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the status quo has always been the private sector, right? So like, at least it's something that we know, but there's all different ways that the private sector can pull tricks. And especially with like financial applications, right? There usually is some type of consumer safeguards in place to try to protect people from, I don't know, abuse of power, right? Like there's always like some type of abuse of power that people it's almost like the public shock is a way to check and balance the private sector. So having these types of calls, having people like your friend that was that gets debanked from Coinbase, right? Having those types of examples are actually right. How people come together and check and balance, you know, the Coinbase.
Somebody just told me right before I got on with Steve that Coinbase has come out with a social credit system, but I had it on my list to follow up, and I didn't really understand what they were talking about. Do you know anything about it?
There's probably like what I was talking about with MasterCard, with like the green energy, like they rate you on all your purchases and try to give you loyalty points or something to that degree. I could see something like that. That seems like the most common one was with like the green energy people.
So is there any exchange? Is there any crypto exchange that has a real affinity for the customer and doesn't play games like Coinbase just did to Kirsch? Who's, is there any trustworthy exchange?
No, I mean, these are all, at the end of the day, like, where are they getting their money from? They're getting their money from the banks, right? So whatever type of credits or whatever type of philosophies that the banks have, they just pass it on to the exchanges, right? So
right.
I mean, like, how many people do you really know in real life that like care about green energy or like the environment, right? It's mostly coming from like Wall Street or some type of corporation that's like pushing that type of narrative. I've never really come across that too much in real life. Like people in New York seem to care a little bit more about the environment, but it's certain narratives that it's like the banking institution gets, and it just passes it down to whoever's taking their loans
right.
for them, right? Like if they got a loan or whatever they find important, the whoever gets the loan is going to find important, and they just make it conditions on the loan.
So if you're listening to this and you say we're in a very dynamic period with what's happening with crypto, I want to understand and be able to track it, I can come to your channel. You've got a YouTube channel and you've got a Patreon channel and you're on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I can follow what you're saying. How else can I stay current on what's going on in crypto in a way that you think is trustworthy? Where do you get your information? What do you think the best sources of information for us to make sense of what's happening?
Well, everyone's got some sort of bias, right? So like whoever I tell you to follow, they're going to have embedded biases. I'm going to have embedded biases. But basically crypto Twitter is probably the best way to get a well-balanced look and everything. So Twitter's always been kind of the town square of crypto. So whatever the topic is, you just find what's trending and you just read about the topics, and then everybody bickers back and forth, and you could probably get a more well-rounded viewpoint than most. So it's probably be in the town square of Twitter. There's CoinDesk, Cointelegraph, those types of websites that report specifically on crypto news, but they're usually biased towards Bitcoin. Usually they're biased towards Bitcoin and Ethereum. They try to
right.
And they push away from some of the other coins. So I'd say they're more biased. So crypto Twitter is probably the best.
So one of the things I most like about your approach is you're looking at this very much looking at what is the impact of the distributed ledger technology on the whole economy. So you're looking at it from a macro standpoint, and it's much more integrated with, you know, here's crypto, but here's how it's impacting the whole system. Here's the interaction between the whole economy and this change.
Sure.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I take the macroeconomics into consideration. I mean, basically, like, all these older systems, they're really inefficient. So if you're able to just upgrade all these payment infrastructures into, you know, almost near time, near real time payments, I mean, what does that do to the economy? I just kind of extrapolate from out. I mean, a lot of the inefficiency that we have was almost by design to make systems so they can catch people doing nefarious things. Because if you have a system that's 2 weeks old, it gives the payment regulators time to go through all the transactions and see what exactly is going on. So, I mean, that's been the majority of this, is just making sure people are.
So. I want to make a plug for inefficiency. And my plug for inefficiency is, if creating asset tokenization makes it easier for someone to seize all your assets quickly and without many steps, that's not an efficiency I want. Or if it makes it easier for them to, if I can't pay my debt today, to liquidate a fraction of my house with an asset tokenization, that's not an efficiency that works for me. So there are advantages to lower cost in transactions, but there are disadvantages. You know, I used to work in government and we would have these 26-step processes. And we would have the 26 steps to make sure that the process really did what it was supposed to, instead of a high-speed, defraud. A lot of the fraud in mortgage finance has been facilitated by much faster, much more efficient process. And in fact, you know, it's much faster and it's much more efficient, but there's, you know, you integrate in all the fraud and it's worse.
Right.
So the integrity of the system has gone down, even though it's faster and more efficient. So where you have players who all have integrity, it's fantastic. When the players don't have integrity, it makes things much, much worse. And we're just about to record a big series on called Protecting Your Assets. And our first part is going to be on how you navigate sort of all the financial fraud minefield. And we've spent weeks building up sort of the outline and looking at all the frauds we've dealt with over many, many years. And what we realized is, you know, digital technology has literally facilitated a blossoming of financial frauds and scams that would never have been possible until we had faster, more efficient processing. It's quite extraordinary. So there are certain times and certain places where I would argue for the old inefficient system. So we have to find a way to combine new efficiency with old integrity or historical. I don't know. Integrity seems like it's out the window these days. So
yeah, I wonder why that is. Like, like a move away from religion, right? Like a lot of things earlier on were like more oriented towards religion. So you gotta wonder why that is, why integrity seems to go out the window. And that's not just with like society, right? It's like even embedded into the public sector, even these companies, right? They have like their own ideas and morals that they take on shape.
I think it's very helpful if you want to centralize power and control to debase the culture. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
But to me, you get the greatest financial system if you can combine high integrity with high speed. And it's funny, when I was on Wall Street, we always, and forgive me, real estate people, for saying this, everybody on Wall Street hated real estate because transactions were so slow and so expensive, whereas securities, comparatively was, very high speed and very inexpensive. And we just thought, but, on Wall Street, on the syndicate desk, You know, if you said 9 7/8, it was 9 7/8, and you better close that trade. And if you didn't, you were dead. You were fired. You were out. You know, it, low integrity was not tolerated because at those speeds, you couldn't have it. And, you know, and it's funny, we did everything with number two pencils and landlines, but we kept our word.
Sure.
And yeah, and it worked. Okay, well, Darren, this has been fascinating. I hope we can check in with you later this year to see see how it's going. Tell everybody how to find you and how to connect with your work and how to follow you and support you, okay?
I'm Fame21 Moore at on Twitter or on YouTube, just Darren Moore Jr. You can find me at patreon.com/Fame21Moore too. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
And you know, I didn't ask you this. We talked about it last time, but you should tell everybody how you ended up as being someone I view as a leading expert on what's going on in the crypto world. How did that happen?
I don't know. I just got obsessed. Like as I was buying coins just to find other investments, and as they're taking off, like I had to figure out what was going on, and then like eventually I just turned into making it into a YouTube channel. I don't know really how it happened.
Yeah, but I think we're in a world that's changing rapidly, and it's a message that says you just dive in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Digging in.
Yeah, dive in. Okay, Darren Moore Jr., thank you very much for joining us on the Solera Report. You have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Catherine.